we kind of look ridiculous. We're gathered around one microphone on a fucking step stool. Ashley's in a bathrobe. We don't need to live stream this.
Sir Balloon Test for a live stream. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree.
Live to tape.
Live to tape, recording in the same room in Jabber Studios 2.0, San Diego. I am recording here with my co-host, Keith Foster.
Yes, and finally, we are joined by my lovely wife, because it's her house.
Yes.
and I pay the mortgage bill.
Yeah. So with us is Ashley Lawrence, my wife. She kept her last name because feminism, y'all.
Also, you're forgetting. It's a doctor.
Yes. Dr. Ashley Lawrence.
Dr. Ashley.
And also in San Diego is Cassidy Robinson, who's normally in L.A.
Yes.
Normally, you're just a black screen on the computer and you look like a serial killer.
So, yeah, I'm in town. I'm visiting my parents. They're doing birthday stuff. I figured we could get this out of the way. We saw the movies.
Yeah, this was kind of an ordeal because you chose to visit on a week when I'm suddenly getting very busy again.
Mm-hmm. You were just in L.A., actually.
Yes, I was in L.A. on Saturday. I had my first UCB class. Then I came home that night. And then Ashley and I went to Disneyland on Sunday. And that's when I was like, I don't know if I'm going to get to watch this because then I had a meeting for Tonight in San Diego on Monday. So I'm like, I know I won't be able to watch it Monday night. So we actually watched it in downtown Disney. We watched Paddington. We went to Disneyland, watched Paddington.
Yeah, we drove an hour and a half, paid for Disneyland parking, renewed our passes, and then instead of going to the park, we went to Paddington 2. There was literally, it was at 1:20 p.m. on Super Bowl Sunday, and we watched Paddington 2, and we were the, like, fourth couple in the theater. Of course, everybody else also had a child.
Yes.
So...
And I think I was the only one, like, openly laughing in the theater, so I sounded like a crazy person.
I went late at night, as per usual, and I was...
So you also looked like a crazy person. You looked like a pedophile.
Probably a little. But there were, like, two other couples. It was, like, literally six people at a huge auditorium.
Okay. That's good. Yeah. No children?
No. This was like 10:30 at night.
For the record, Cassidy is not a pedophile. I just thought that'd be a very strange sight.
If it were 10:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
But that is something to note. When I was looking for Paddington times, there was not a whole lot of late showings. And we're like, oh, that's probably because children are in bed.
Yeah.
And adult humans don't see Paddington 2 on Super Bowl Sunday at Disneyland.
Phantom Thread was not playing at Disneyland, so our options were limited.
All right. So today we're going to be, if you haven't figured it out already, we're going to be talking about Paddington 2. And we're finally going to get to Patrick's request, the documentary Icarus, for our Netflix homework.
Yes, that he requested back in October.
Back in October. And instead of our movie news, and one of the reasons we have Ashley Lawrence here, is we're going to do a little bit of a lead up to the Oscar season. So we're going to talk about the nominations, which we didn't do last time, but we're going to make some predictions. And then we're going to, after the Oscars actually air, we'll have Ashley back on to see how we did. And we'll talk about the telecast and everything.
Yeah, we'll do a post-Oscar recap. Ashley will probably talk about some red carpet stuff.
That's right. God gets that fashion in there. This is my prediction. for the fashion, lots of pantsuits. Lots and lots of pantsuits.
That would make sense. That'd be a good call.
I don't have that many specific predictions. Actually, who's even hosting the damn Oscars?
Who's not a sex offender in Hollywood right now?
That's a pretty small list.
pretty narrow list. I say it's Jimmy Kimmel?
Is it Kimmel?
Or was that last year?
We are live to tape. Yeah, it's Kimmel.
Correct.
Jimmy Kimmel.
I'm correct.
J. Kim's. Okay, so we'll get into it since we're already talking about it. Let's go ahead.
Oscar time! I don't know.
I think we should also know it is the 90th Oscars. Oh, it's a big 90.
That is a big deal. Yeah, they definitely won't be wearing black, though.
And I am currently trying to remember. I don't know if 90 anniversary gifts are a thing, because I think most people are dead by then.
Yeah, I don't think so. I wonder if there's anyone who's been to, like, every year of the Oscars.
Some of those, like, original Academy members, I'm sure.
Yeah, like, that's technically feasible.
Yeah.
That's pretty crazy.
They'll probably have some bit about that.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to start here with cinematography, and we're going to, now, the way I'm going to present this is I'm going to ask all of us to share what our Vegas bet is and what we want in our heart.
Okay.
So, cinematography, the runners are...
Should we just go, like, left or right?
Sure, yeah.
Just for ease?
We'll start with you.
Okay.
Okay, so cinematography, it's Blade Runner 2049 by Roger Deakins, who's never won an Oscar before.
Don't do that. Just read the nominees.
Just saying.
You're going to... This is going to take forever. Just read the nominees.
Darkest Hour by Bruno de Bonal. Dunkirk by Hoyt Van Hoytima. Mudbound by Rachel Morrison. And Shape of Water by Dan Lauston. Keith, what is your Vegas bet?
Vegas bet is Dunkirk. In my heart, I want Blade Runner 2049.
Every year, I think it's Roger Deakins' year. I'm going to put it on this year. I think this will be the Blade Runner award that it gets. So that is Vegas and heart, actually.
My Vegas would be The Shape of Water.
Good pick.
And my heart would be Mudbound, because, fun fact, it is the first female ever cinematographer to ever be nominated.
That's a good...
Hashtag time's up. Hashtag women, hashtag I didn't see the movie.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good call. Like, we'll see how political the Oscars want to get this year. And I wouldn't be surprised if they did that.
All right. Original screenplay, The Big Sick by Emily Gordon and Kumail Nanjiani. Get Out by Jordan Peele. Lady Bird by Greta Gerwig. Shape of Water by Guillermo del Toro and Vanessa Taylor. And Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri by Martin McDonagh. This is a very competitive category. Keith, what is your Vegas bet?
I think Vegas bet is this is going to be the one award Lady Bird gets. I think has had some of the most character-driven stuff, and I think the Academy is going to award that. Heart of hearts, I want The Big Sick, just because I want Kumail to win an Oscar, and Emily Gordon. I think it'd be really cool if they won. He's been tweeting crazy about it. It's it's pretty fun to follow him right now, because every other tweet's just like, when they got nominated, one of the cutest things was he tweeted at Emily Gordon. He's like, oh, hey, babe, look, we got nominated for an Oscar. And they've just been obnoxious and cute about it. And I just really want that for him. So
that would be cool.
And her.
And her, yes.
And her.
Thank you.
Vegas, I'm going to say this is the one award Get Out gets.
All right.
Because the best original screenplay is always kind of a wild card award. It's the Dark Horse award. But heart is Lady Bird.
This is a tough category.
This is really tough.
This is sort of tough, because I loved pretty much all these movies. And I'm a huge fan of Lady Bird for many reasons. But I think, honestly, truly, I think Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri is actually going to take it.
Mm-hmm.
And my heart is so hard. My heart's with all of them. But I think my heart would be Lady Bird. I mean, I love Lady Bird.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I could see this being the one big award Three Billboards gets.
Yeah, because it's very writerly. But Martin McDonagh already, I think, won or was nominated for In Bruges for the same award.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, adapted screenplay. Call Me By Your Name by James Ivory. The Disaster Artist by Scott Neustadter and Michael H. Weber. Logan. I can't believe I got nominated. It's by Scott Frank and James Mangold and Michael Green. Molly's Game by Aaron Sorkin, a movie nobody saw. And Mudbound, again, by Virgil Williams and Dee Reese. I didn't know she wrote that. This is a hard one for me because there's stuff I haven't seen and stuff I didn't know actually got nominated.
I only saw two of these, so this one's a shot in the dark. I think Call Me By Your Name will win. I think this will be the one award it gets.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, if I'm going with my heart of hearts, my heartiest heart,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to say Logan because I think it'd be pretty fucking cool to have a comic book movie like with superheroes win fucking adapted screenplay. That'd be sort of crazy. So I want that just as like my nerdy self.
Sure.
But yeah, I think Call Me By Your Name will win.
I'm going to say both Heart and Vegas, Call Me By Your Name. I agree. I think this is the award it gets.
I would say, I was going to say Disaster Artist, but hashtag Time's Up recently. I don't think it's happening.
I think it's going to get shut out.
So, yeah, I'm going to go with Call Me By Your Name. Unfortunately, did not see my Ben or Molly's Game, so I cannot say to them. And my heart of hearts is Logan. Holy shit. Like, I love that movie.
Yeah.
I wish it had been talked about even more. And why isn't that little girl nominated?
Yeah.
For real, though.
Kind of, yeah.
She was fantastic.
I think it's surprising that Logan got nominated for anything.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of the least comic booky of the comic book movies, so it doesn't surprise me that this is the one that does get nominated.
Yeah. Still, I'm pretty surprised. Okay, animated feature. Keith's favorite movie, Boss Baby, by Tom McGrath.
Boss Baby!
And
Cookies Are for Closers!
Then we know where your heart is. And Ramsey Ann Naito. Breadwinner by Nora Tomwe and Anthony Leo. Coco by Lee Unkrich and Darla K. Anderson. Ferdinand by Carlos Sandalna. Loving Vincent by Dorota Kobila. I have not practiced these names.
Yeah,
Hugh Welchman, Sean Bobbitt, blah, 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 all the people. So I'm going to say...
Dude, you keep going out of order, motherfucker. Heart and... I didn't see The Breadwinner or Loving Vincent or Ferdinand. I didn't see any of them but Coco. The Breadwinner and Loving Vincent, I don't know anything about. Ferdinand looked terrible. Boss Baby looked terrible. Vegas Odds and Heart, Coco. Hands down, all day, air day.
Samesies. This is a pretty easy category.
Yeah, this isn't Pixar turning in Cars 3.
Yeah.
Or Planes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it'd be ridiculous if Coco didn't win, and it's like kind of laughable that they even tried to put anybody else in this category, because it's just the Pixar war every year, and unfortunately, we bring out Coco and about such a great...
There were better animated films than this, so,
you know,
hello, Captain Underpants. Anybody? Captain Underpants?
Hey, you know what? I wrote my own Captain Underpants comic when I was in grade school, and it was fantastic, but I did not see that movie.
I will admit, there is a small sliver, like that dark part of my heart, that would really enjoy it if Boss Baby did win. I would feel like Coco was ripped the fuck off.
Yeah.
But I think that'd be hilarious.
I would get people 2016 election trauma all over again. okay, director. This is it, man. Dunkirk, Christopher Nolan, Get Out, Jordan Peele.
Are we not doing like actors and stuff?
It's in a weird...
Oh, order. You're reading the
I'm
variety.
Reading it from Variety, that's right.
I'm looking at a ballot, so I kind of have to jump around here.
Lady Bird, Greta Gerwig, Phantom Thread, Paul Thomas Anderson, and Shape of Water, Guillermo del Toro.
So this one's really hard for me because...
we're basically predicting Best Picture here.
Not necessarily. They've been splitting it a lot more lately, and I think it's going to be a split this year.
Yeah.
So the only ones we didn't see...
Phantom Thread.
Yeah, that's the only one I haven't seen out of this. There's only two that I would be really upset if they won, and that's Christopher Nolan, because I think Dunkirk was just can't hold up to the other ones, and I didn't see Phantom Thread, so I don't have any dog in the race there. I think Guillermo del Toro will probably win for The Shape of Water. And my heart wants that, but my heart also wants Jordan Peele, and my heart also wants Greta Gerwig. But I think it's going to be a Guillermo del Toro. He's been in the game for so long, and I think the Academy, you don't know what you're going to get with Guillermo del Toro. So, like, the Academy might not know if he'll have another Oscar-worthy movie for a few years. So I think they're going to award it to him.
I agree. My Vegas is Guillermo del Toro. My heart is Lady Bird again. But this is another really competitive category.
Yeah, shit. This category is rough. I would sort of agree with you guys. I think though, I'm gonna pull a curveball because sometimes the Academy likes to throw things that we're not expecting. I think Greta Gerwig might actually win it.
Yeah.
And which would make my heart sing.
Yeah.
And I mean that it's I'm gonna be talking about Lady Bird all day. Like I think it's gonna win and it's what I wanna win.
I think it's a solid choice. And the last few years the Oscars have made an effort to try and be more aware. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to hurt Jordan Peele's chances because Moonlight did so well last year.
Yeah.
He doesn't sounds shitty to say, but they're not going to give him a token award.
Mm-hmm.
I think he absolutely deserves the award, but I think the other three do as well.
I think ultimately that's why I gave Get Out to original screenplay.
Yeah.
Because it's so pulpy, it's so genre, and I think that's going to hurt Guillermo del Toro in the long run too, but the big competitors here, I think what we're looking at is it's going to be the Lady Bird, Shape of Water, and
Get Out show.
No, and Three Billboards.
Oh yeah, that's true.
Those are going to be. So let's go ahead and get into supporting actress: Mary J. Blige from Mudbound, Allison Janney for I, Tonya, Leslie Mansfield for Phantom Thread, Laurie Metcalf for Lady Bird, Octavia Spencer for Shape of Water. So
for this one, the only one I've seen is Lady Bird and Shape of Water.
Uh-huh.
I think Vegas odds are on Allison Janney because I think she's been cleaning up the other award circuits, hasn't she?
No, only you're thinking of her work on Mom. She's been winning Emmys for years, but I don't think she's been winning as much for the other awards.
Won the Golden Globe for I, Tonya.
On her comedy, maybe?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
I think it was for comedy.
Yeah.
But I
didn't look at the acting guild.
I think it's going to be Allison Janney, which I've heard she's great, but in my heart I want Laurie Metcalf because I think she absolutely deserves it, and I only have it to compare to Octavia Spencer, really.
Right. This is the battle of the two bad mothers. I
don't think Laurie Metcalf was a bad mom.
Yeah, and I mean, if we're going to get on this train, Laurie Metcalf was not a bad mother in any capacity.
A prickly mother.
No, I think she was a stressed out mom with a husband who didn't provide, didn't do anything. And all she wanted to do is have this reciprocated love of her daughter. And it's difficult. It's difficult to have teenage. It made me just call your mom. Just call your mom. She's more complicated than you realize, and she does a lot more than you realize. Fair and dads enough. Get all the credit. And what did her dad do? He did shit. He did fucking shit in the whole fucking movie.
Hey, he
call
got
your
her
goddamn mom.
He got her into college. Okay, so I think this is Laurie Metcalf. And I'm going to say Vegas and Hart on this one.
All right.
Laurie Metcalf. Yeah. I don't know why I would even pick okay. anyone else.
I think absurd. I love amazing. Allison Janney in I, Tonya. It's a really good role, but it is a little campy and it is a little big.
The reason I thought she was winning a lot of the other awards, so that's why I think she's going to get it. But yeah, I'd be very happy if Laurie Metcalf won. So,
supporting actor: Willem Dafoe in The Florida Project, Woody Harrelson in Three Billboards, Richard Jenkins in Shape of Water, Christopher Plummer in All the Money in the World, Sam Rockwell for Three Billboards. Yeah, that's the category.
Vegas is Sam Rockwell. All the buzz is it's his year.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't see All the Money in the World. I think he's sort of a dark horse, the political.
Yeah. To make an example.
Yeah.
Someone who wasn't even originally supposed to be in the movie.
Yeah. And I haven't seen that, and I haven't seen The Florida Project. I've heard Willem Dafoe was great. I'm going to say Sam Rockwell is Vegas odds. I'd really like it if Richard Jenkins won. I thought he was he brought such warmth to that movie. I think he really did what best supporting actors are supposed to do. I'm not mad at either, though. I think both of them deserve it.
Yeah, this is another really good category. I'm going to go Vegas odds, Sam Rockwell, even though I think his role is... I have issues with his role in that movie, but...
I think a lot of... It's not the best Sam Rockwell role.
No,
It's more of a legacy award.
Yeah, and also, like, just, like, it's just his year kind of thing.
Yeah.
For me, it's This Is Easy. For Hart, it's Willem Dafoe. I love the Florida Project, and I love him in that movie.
I've heard good things.
I would say... Sam Rockwell, I agree with everyone.
For Vegas.
For Vegas, for sure. I loved Richard Jenkins. I think he said it. He was so pleasant. I love Richard Jenkins and everything, though.
Yeah.
He's just so adorable, and you want to hold him and make him feel better.
He elevates everything he's in.
At the same time, he's like a grandpa to you. It's just like this whole all-in-one.
The 1 hour that's at all watchable in Eat, Pray, Love is the hour with Richard Jenkins.
All right, let's keep going. We got a lot to get through.
We got a lot, yeah. Okay, lead actress.
I will also go first this time.
Okay.
Discusses everything before it gets to me.
Hashtag he for she.
All right.
Lead actress Sally Hawkins in Shape of Water, Frances McDormand in Three Billboards, Margot Robbie in I, Tonya, Saoirse Ronan.
Saoirse like inertia.
Saoirse Ronan in Lady Bird, and Meryl Streep in The Post.
Okay. It is to note, this is Meryl's 20th nomination. Right. She's only won 3, so her odds are not great. But it also was the most boring performance I've ever seen from her. I was so disappointed with Meryl Streep in this performance. Mm. Sally Hawkins, holy shit. That performance is so great, and she's not going to win, and it makes me sad because it's such a beautiful part to play, and she has literally no lines. Uh-huh. It's incredible.
But you could argue she has less to memorize.
You're a horrible person. And honestly, Frances McDormand, she's gonna win. Yeah. I mean, you can't not watch her. She is
it's her movie.
Yeah, she's just this inertia that you can't stop.
Well, and that movie kind of lives and dies on her performance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, of course, my heart of hearts, Saoirse Ronan, who's I would love to win. But she's young. She's got many of yours. I mean, this is her second nomination already. She's going to be fine.
Yeah, I think.
So you're putting Vegas odds at Frances and.
Yes, my love for Saoirse.
Okay.
Same exact answer.
My Vegas odds is Frances McDormand, but my heart of hearts is Sally Hawkins. I think it's harder to communicate, that amount of emotion and story, without any dialogue. And, mm-hmm. and she does it so gracefully. And she fucks a fucking fish. And but makes it believable. Like, you believe she's in love with a fucking fish monster. So, like, I think she just has sort of...
She had a lot to do.
Yeah, she had a really... Yeah, so she's my heart of
hearts. Oscars do like to award people with affectations, though. Like fucking the King's Speech. And,
right. You
know. Yeah. So we'll see how that one goes.
Okay, lead actor, Timothy Chalamet in Call Me By Your Name. D-Day in Phantom Thread. Daniel Kaluuya in Get Out. Gary Oldman in Darkest Hour. Denzel Washington in Roman J. Israel Esquire.
So here's what I think is kind of fucking bullshit with this category. I mean, Gary Oldman, Denzel Washington... Nobody saw those movies. Nobody cared. Nobody cared about Darkest Hour. Nobody cared about Roman J. Israel. Like, he's only getting nominated because he's Denzel, and that's frustrating. But whatever. My heart or Vegas odds of Gary Oldman. Everyone's saying it's his year. Is buzz about him. Heart of Hearts is again. There's a few I didn't. There's a lot I didn't see here. But Heart of Hearts is Daniel Kaluuya.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was incredible in Get Out. So,
I have Vegas, Gary Oldman for sure. That's seriously a legacy. Timothy Chalamet. I think he has a lot to do in that movie. It's a really difficult role to play, to both play wise beyond your years and naive at the same time.
I'm going to go against the house and say Oscar curveball. For some reason, the Oscars love to like give their young rising youth Oscars. So I think Timothy Chalamet is actually going to take it like unexpectedly. And Heart of Hearts, Daniel Kaluuya.
Yeah. Now, the one thing we're not mentioning here is that supposedly Phantom Thread is Daniel Day-Lewis's last movie.
That's true, but he's won so many fucking Oscars.
He's won three already, and he's been nominated 5 times. So this would be six.
Yeah.
Even if he doesn't win, he's still at 50% of the time he gets nominated, he wins.
Yeah.
So I don't think they're going to give him the Legacy Award. They would give it to Gary Oldman before D-Day Lou.
Yeah.
D-Day Lou, my darling.
Final category, Best Picture. Call Me By Your Name, Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, Get Out, Lady Bird, Phantom Thread, The Post, Shape of Water, Three Billboards. Go for it. If you have
goddamn Lady Bird. Should be Lady Bird. 100% Lady Bird. And it's going to be Three Billboards. Because it's not going to be Lady Bird. Because I know in my heart of hearts, it will be.
I think in line with Cassidy's theory for... You said Greta Gerwig will win director, right?
No.
Oh, you said Guillermo.
I think it's going to be... She's going to win the original
screenplay.
Or I want her to. I forget now.
I think... Honestly, I think it'll be The Shape of Water. I think Vegas it is the most nominated. It's weird, but it also... pays tribute to old Hollywood in a weird way. Like,
yeah.
It's weird to me how much critics have liked Shape of Water, but I think it'll be Shape of Water. In my heart, I want Get Out. I want a horror movie hasn't won in a long time. I want, I don't think it will, again, because, won last year?
Huh?
Moonlight?
I couldn't think of the name. I wanted to call it Midnight.
Oh, okay.
I think that's going to hurt Get Out's odds. I think it's racist as fuck, but Hollywood's racist. I think they gave all the awards to a black movie last year. They're not going to do it this year.
Oh, probably not. But it is interesting that those two films are the pulpiest of the bunch. But Three Billboards is, too. It's just a different kind. It's a crime pulp.
I think it's going to get kind of shut out, but...
I think... they might go with that one. I'm going to put Vegas on Three Billboards. So I think that's the same answer as you, Ashley. And of course, I would love Lady Bird to win, because I think it's pretty obvious that me and Ashley have a love affair with Greta Gerwig and Lady Bird.
I didn't get to do the podcast for Lady Bird, and I was just so blown away how I could like seriously attach to a movie so closely. I mean, it takes place in like 2002.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, that is prime time for me. I wasn't technically in high school yet, but I went to a private school. Like, I went to theater. Like, I'm not in any way, shape, close to Lady Bird as a character. It was just weird how much it really associated with me. And after I saw that movie, the first thing I did is I told my friend who went to Catholic school in California, I said, you need to go see this movie with a high school friend. It's going to blow your mind. And it did.
Has she seen it?
She did. She did. Okay. She finally saw it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that was our big takeaway, too, was like, even though we're pretty far removed from the character, it was so relatable of just being young at that time that I...
Well, it's what I said when we did our top 10. It's such a mirror film. Everybody sees themselves somewhere in
absolutely,
it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And here's the thing, if it wins all these awards, I'm not mad at it. I don't have any, I loved it too.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
And if Greta Gerwig has a chance of sweeping, it's through the Me Too momentum.
Again,
which I wish that it wasn't shitty politics that did that. It should win because it's clearly the best movie, but
I agree. We'll see. I think the same thing for Get Out. And I think it sucks that the politics of it, I think, hurt its odds because it was my favorite movie last year. But, you know, there were so many good movies that as long as Dunkirk doesn't sweep, I'll be happy.
Yeah, now there is a weird kind of, like, Hollywood love of Dunkirk. And Nolan has been ignored for so many years.
It's a dark horse.
If there is a dark horse, it's Dunkirk.
Yeah. All right. So that's our official Oscar
predicts.
Stuffs.
I'll go through this and make a spreadsheet and send it to you guys. You can mark these off when you're watching.
No, that's great. If anyone wants to play along, who listens to the podcast, see how you did compared to our stuff.
And you could probably get drunk with how many times Keith says,
I don't know. I've heard podcasts where people do it worse, so.
Yeah. Okay. P2, everybody.
Oh, my God.
We got... Now, Ashley, did you see Paddington 1 with Keith when we reviewed it last year?
I did. Yeah, I've pretty much seen almost every movie except for a couple more like Netflixy movies and Girl on a Train. I did not see. Oh, and the Tupac movie. I did not see.
Yeah,
yeah,
the worst ones.
Which is funny. It came up today. The Tupac movie at work. a pharmacist at work. She's like, "Hey, have you seen this movie on HBO?
Did they like it?"
She loved it, and I had to say, you know, I didn't see that one, but I was like secretly like Keith hated it.
Here's the thing: if you don't know a lot about movies and you're a Tupac fan,
yeah,
I could see liking it. It's not good, but it's a mess, but it's not like Batman v Superman bad where anyone should be able to go, no, this is trash.
It's like growing up in the 90s and not having any superhero material to really attach yourself to, so you force yourself to like the Flash television series.
Yeah. Honestly, it feels like...
Because it's the only one there is.
If that movie had come out as a VH1 original in 1999, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But nowadays, there's not really any excuses.
Right. So there's hot takes on All Eyes on Me.
That's why Ashley doesn't get to guest on the podcast, is because she skips all the awful shit. She didn't even finish
El Camino.
Fucking El Camino Christmas.
And it was
her goddamn pick.
it,
You know excuses.
It was so bad.
So bad.
And it was just, it had all these stars in it. And I was like, yeah, this will be a fun Christmas heist movie.
It was neither fun nor particularly Christmassy.
Come on, Netflix. That was terrible money.
Okay. Well, Ashley, I'm going to give you the honors of describing to us what is the plot of Paddington 2.
Oh, goody. So, Paddington 2. If you haven't seen Paddington 1, I highly suggest it. So, Paddington is this adorable little bear who loves marmalade and is so British.
Obscenely British.
And the entire plot of Paddington 2 is, it opens with Paddington meeting his aunt. And how they met, and he wants to get her a birthday gift because she raised him and gave him everything in her life. And all this poor bear aunt wanted to do was go to London, and she'd never been to London, but she sends her nephew to London, and he lives in this great London life. And so essentially throughout the movie is just him wanting to get this beautiful gift for his aunt. And unfortunately, Bean Paddington gets up to some hijinks and ends up in jail for a good majority of the movie, which is honestly the best part of the movie. Mm-hmm. And it's just about this little bear trying to get his aunt a gift.
Trying to get his aunt a pop-up book that was and framed for the theft of the pop-up book by none other than Hugh Grant as a master of disguise vaudevillian.
An actor who's down on his luck, who uses his skill as an actor to steal the book and uncover a secret treasure.
Yeah. So it's revealed, spoiler, that this... precious London pop-up book that Paddington innocently wants to get for his aunt to show her London instead of buying her a goddamn ticket to London. He buys her, wants to buy her pop-up book that happens to be the only one like left in existence. So it's very, very valuable, and it gets stolen. And Paddington is framed, hence the jail.
Yes.
Yeah.
That pretty much covers it. So I'll start. I was kind of lukewarm on the first Paddington. I thought that I understood why people liked it. I understood why the first Paddington got so much love. It was warm. It was fairly smart. I still thought there was a lot of kiddie tropes that and a lot of dumb physical humor that I had issues with. I also didn't really care for Nicole Kidman in the first movie as kind of this...
Yeah, she was this...
A taxidermy.
Yeah, she was like this vampy taxidermist who was trying to kill Paddington because he was a talking bear, but that kind of doesn't make sense because his whole appeal is that he's a talking bear, and if you kill him, the taxidermy bear's not going to talk. So there's sort of a huge plot hole with her motivation.
Yeah, I felt that she was mostly not needed. I actually think that this movie improves everything.
It's the Spider-Man 2 of Paddington.
It is the Spider-Man 2 of Paddington's, totally. It takes everything that I thought worked about the first one, gets rid of, for the most part, all of the stuff I don't like. There's a few physical gags in the movie. There's this one... where he's trying to learn how to wash windows, and he's using a pulley, and it's cute and fun or whatever, but I thought, I was like, okay, here we go again with more of this. And there's another one where he's at a barber shop where he's trying to
that was the one that bugged me.
That was the most like the first one. However, later it is revealed that it had a story purpose.
Yeah.
It has a plot point.
That's true.
So I was like, okay, good for you, movie. And I love the stuff with him in prison. Brendan Gleeson plays Knuckles, disgruntled prison chef who he ends up sort of teaming up with or becomes his protector. And Brendan Gleeson pulls some great faces throughout the movie. And he kind of leans into his, like, tough guy, like, gangstery stuff we've seen him do and stuff like in Bruges or whatever. I think he's a lot of fun in the movie.
In Bruges, Gangs of New York. He was Mad Eye Moody, right?
Yeah.
So he's always had sort of been typecast as a street tough.
Yeah. As Exactly. Kind of a geezer style, like, gangster villain. And, you know, Hugh Grant is just camping it the hell up, but he's in, it's a role that allows for him to do that. The only thing I think is kind of curious about the movie, I'd be interested to hear what you guys say about this, is that we put Paddington in jail the whole time, while Hugh Grant is in a much funner plot on a treasure map quest.
Okay. I had a couple tiny issues with that, because we didn't, I thought Hugh Grant was great, and I thought that he was a much more likable villain and much more charismatic villain, and he just had more going on. Like, he was sort of schizophrenic and was, like, talking to himself as his past roles.
He's talking to his wigs.
Yeah, he was like the DC animated Clayface.
Pretty much.
But yeah, so he was just a lot more compelling than Nicole Kidman.
Integrated in the plot.
They did away with both of the things you didn't really like from the first one either. But so they're sort of set up this fun treasure hunt thing. And I feel like we didn't see quite enough of that. Like, we see him dress up a couple times, but it sort of is later. He's like, oh, I have all the clues. And I'm like, what? Like, we only actually see him get a couple. And I feel like there was some more fun they could have had with that. But I mean, really, this movie should have been called Paddington Goes to Jail.
Well, that's what it is.
Yeah, it's like, and that's the juice of the movie. So I wasn't mad that we spent more time with Paddington in jail, because he was so cute and it was so funny, all the stuff he did in jail.
Yeah, and his whole, like, clumsy, oh, I didn't mean to do that, like, that stuff plays really well in a jail environment.
And they kind of they just kind of start ignoring that. Like, we know Paddington is lovable. We know he's cute. Mm-hmm. And they just rely on that less once he's in prison. What are your thoughts, Ashley?
Well, I loved Paddington 2. Mm-hmm. I was pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
Heartly warmed. And I wish he was real and that I could own him. And also, I mean, I have an obsession with British, like British everything. It's like, it just.
An Anglophile.
Yeah. It fed that fuel more than I really should have. And I was just like, wish I could be even more British and live in London and have a Paddington bear. I would agree. The most delightful stuff of the movie was the prison. And it reminded me a lot of, like, a Wes Anderson film. Like, a lot of Grand Budapest Hotel. But I think it was just because...
It's a similar color palette.
A fun little gag where Paddington has to do the laundry as his jail duty. And he leaves a red sock in with all of the jail clothes. So then all the jail clothes turn pink. And so then the entire rest of the movie, they're all wearing pink jail clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Which later comes back at the end of the movie. And they're still in pink jail clothes, which I think is funny. They decided not to change it back to the normal, regular black and white stripes.
Here's the thing. I think the Paddington franchise is the best non-Pixar kids fare right now. Like, Paddington was really funny without being crass. Without relying on fart jokes. I mean, there's a couple jokes at the beginning where he, like, puts the toothbrushes in his ears and stuff. But it's not gross-out humor that a lot of these kids' movies rely on.
And I think the reason why is because it's British.
I think in the heart, that's kind of true because, English people are known for being... It's sort of a stereotype how polite British people are now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Paddington's character too, and two, he's polite and he's hopeful and he's optimistic, like, to the core. Like, even in prison, he's polite to the prisoners and everything. So I do think that there is something to him being British that does affect that. I just thought it was really funny and really cute and just way more directed than a children's movie needs to be.
Very art directed, for sure. Paul King definitely has a vision here. He's not just bringing Paddington to life. There is a lot of Wes Anderson in here, and I would say the prison escape sequence is maybe a little familiar. You know, there's laundry hampers and that kind of stuff. There's even a very similar sequence in Shape of Water this year. And we've seen similar prison escape sequences. It still plays pretty well, but...
Yeah, and it's a pretty short sequence, actually. They don't spend... They're just like, we have a plan to get out of prison.
Even
all right, go through these convenient doors.
Even Logan Lucky had a similar kind of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I really love sort of the art direction of the movie, especially all of the three-dimensional stuff when we enter into the pop-up book and there's all these panorama shots of them going through the streets of London while it still kind of has this pop-up
style. Yeah, where he's like imagining giving his aunt the book. It was so sweet and like that was like Pixar level emotion for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there was and I'm not going to spoil anything, but there's at the end too.
There's a moment.
Yeah, yeah, there's a moment that
I literally shed a tear in Paddington 2 in the finale in Downtown Disney on Super Bowl Sunday.
Well, it's so heartfelt. Mm-hmm. And I just think it has such a good message. Like, you know, if you look at it overall, it has, you know, it has some weird commentary about the prison industrial complex. I'm going to go there. But, like, just the idea of forgiveness and the people aren't bad, you know.
Right.
Even in the toughest tough, a little politeness, a little kindness can go a long way.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that stuff. I think as far as the dual narrative goes between the prison escape stuff or the prison stuff in general and then this treasure hunt thing, I almost kind of feel like two things happened here. I think that these were two different pitches that somehow got dovetailed in the writing process.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Hugh Grant treasure hunt thing, there's a lot of footage that didn't make it into the movie.
I think so too. Yeah, I think one person was like, I want to do Ernest Goes to Jail. Another person was like, I want to do The Great Muppet Caper. Mm. Another person was like, let's do both. yeah, I can see that. There's probably a Tolkien director's cut.
Yeah, a 5-hour Paddington Peter Jackson.
And then can we also talk about who again? Sally Hawkins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, is she British
Yeah, what? she's a Brit.
That I did not know, but I was like, I should have known from Paddington 1. I just, I've seen her in so many American roles that I forget that.
Also, her chemistry with the dude from Downton Abbey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, I do think the family, which was such a focus of the first movie, they do take a bit of a backseat in this one.
But I like their role in the movie. I felt like they had agency, they had something to do in the movie.
And each one of them, even though it might be a small arc, does have a full story. Mm-hmm. And that does come into play.
Even the son with the trains and all that.
And the girl with the paper. And they all play a part. But Sally Hawkins definitely gets the most screen time, which she deserves. And I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah. But I even like the Hugh, what is the...
The dude from Downton Abbey.
The guy from Downton Abbey.
Yeah, knows him.
I liked him a lot more in this movie because the whole plot of the first one was trying to get him on Paddington's side. So he gets the thankless role of just being a grump the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Here, we're on his side the whole movie.
Yeah, and like his flashback scene.
Yeah, which again, I thought was like kind of obnoxious and weird and out of nowhere until it comes back into the plot.
I loved it. I loved it. That was one of those moments that I'm like, this movie, the director of this movie cares way more about this than the average like director for hire kids movie thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool.
So I think we're all pretty positive on it. I wrote my review.
Positive
about P2. So I wrote my review already. I gave it a B+.
I'd give it an A-.
A plus for me. Paddington 2 warmed my heart.
How about we give you Icarus, which is our Netflix homework. And I actually should have had Ashley do this one with your background in pharmacy. But I'm going to have Keith, you're going to describe to me the plot of the documentary Icarus, which is Oscar nominated. We didn't cover this category in our predictions because we haven't seen enough of the movies.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah, so Icarus is the plot's a little tricky because you think it's about one thing and then it kind of turns into something else.
A switcheroo.
Yeah. Essentially, it sets out to address the issue of illegal doping in
the Olympics.
The Olympics, specifically professional bike riding.
Yeah.
Like the fucking 4Ks or whatever they're called. I don't know. The ones where they go up the mountain. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm fucking talking about.
The bikes.
Marathons.
The bikes. The bicyclists with their little hot pants and their little tight shirts. Specifically referring to like Lance Armstrong and how he was able to get away with doping for so long and was able to clear all these tests. So this one guy, the filmmaker, Brian Fogel, sets out to test this process out. He's going to actively dope and try to get past the system, try to get past the checks to see if he can figure out how they're getting these clean screenings. Then it devolves into this Russian conspiracy about how they've been secretly doping for all of the Olympics in perpetuity, as far as we know. And that's the basic story. It devolves into this crazy Russian Olympic conspiracy.
And a little bit, if we're talking, you know, about genre within genre, because obviously this is a documentary, but there's a little bit of sort of a espionage-y sort of thriller kind of aspect to this movie, the way that it's directed. So the doctor that Brian Fogel sees or is connected to is named Grigory Rodchenkov.
Rodchenkov. Grigory Rodchenkov.
I mean, who's
quite a character in the movie.
And he's not his doctor. Let's roll back there.
Okay.
So he's actually has to go to an American doctor to get prescriptions for, he's getting testosterone and he's getting some other growth hormones and steroid-esque medications.
Yeah.
To help your, basically to kind of give you guys a background, human growth hormone, they use it for body recovery. And what it does is it supposedly helps the body recover quickly. So if you're sick and you took growth hormone, that's a bad example. Like, so you're recovering from surgery and you take it. It helps you recover from the surgery faster. But there is...
repercussions?
No, repercussions. But there's the studies and the data, the scientific data against it is kind of wishy-washy in the medical community. And professional athletes use it because when you're a professional athlete and you're literally using all of your energy and your muscles break down and they get sore, like professional baseball players, they literally, their arms hurt so bad because they're hitting 90 mile an hour balls. So
you hit a wall.
Yeah, you hit a wall. So, but in order to continue going, especially marathon and biking, that's a long process. So they take these medication to keep their body basically to heal itself in time and to go harder than their competitors.
Right, right. So after Fogel like gets in contact with this Grigory character and
Ashley said that he's not his doctor. He's just performing the lab tests to try and illustrate how they might cheat these checks and balances, cuz he works for the Russian government. He works for them and their testing facility.
In WADA.
Yeah. And it's one of those documentaries where, kind of like Exit at the Gift Shop or a few other ones, where you think it's a documentary where it's like, well, okay, so he's making himself the subject. He's making himself, you know, this kind of supersize me sort of approach. But then it turns out that after this conspiracy comes uncovered and the Russian government starts to crack down on their own doping scandal, you know, people are dying of mysterious heart attacks and that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
it kind of gets crazier and crazier as it goes. So given that it is kind of a documentary that has such a switcheroo like that, I don't know, what was your sort of like journey through the movie as you were watching it?
Well, when I was watching it, I knew it had something to do with Russia and the Olympics. So when it starts out with this fucking guy biking, I'm like, what the fuck is this? Like, I thought this was Russia in the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but I thought that was interesting. And then when it takes the turn, I'm like, oh shit, what the fuck is going on? So it's definitely a compelling watch.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of never knew what I was watching, if that makes sense.
Yeah, also to clarify, for people who don't know what WADA is, it's the World Anti-Doping Association.
Yeah.
This professor, Dr. Gregorio, whatever his technical title is.
Yeah.
And so essentially the whole movie devolves into him working for the Olympic Association. And the crazy thing, I think, is he gets to that position for working for WADA after Putin literally pulls him from crazy jail.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, crazy jail to run the Olympic Association.
Mm-hmm. After he himself had a history of doping.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the political intrigue is fascinating and scary as fuck. Russia's scary as fuck.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that this documentary is really relevant to right now, because
sure,
all this Russia shit just keeps coming back around. And so it's definitely pretty relevant there. Yeah.
But the stake, what I think is interesting about the tone of the movie versus the stakes of the movie, the stakes are actually relatively low, because we're just talking about the Olympics, which has it's a global stage for countries to kind of flex.
The stakes are low in a sense that, you know, how much does it really matter? But the stakes are pretty high, because there's a point in the film where, like, I'm actively thinking Grigori's going to die.
Sure, yeah. Well, for the characters.
Yes.
For the characters, the stakes are fairly high. But in the global stakes of what's actually – the type of corruption we're talking about.
Yeah, Russia's – essentially Russia's cheating at a game.
Cheating how to do the Olympics. So – and sometimes if I take a bird's eye view on the movie and I realize that, I start to see the melodrama in the way the story is told.
Sure.
And yes, yeah. If you're that guy and you're worried about never seeing your family again, and you're worried about people, your friends being killed, then that sort of thriller genre stuff is relevant to your personal story. But sometimes I think that the movie is maybe a little hokey with its optics and its melodrama.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, if you devolve any sport down to the fact that this is just a game, sure. But the Olympics are like the, you know, the biggest global sporting event.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, we get fucking upset about the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
So I get why it's such a big deal. It's also, you know, diplomatic relations. That's the point of the Olympics, was for countries to gather as a diplomatic event and to participate in these sports together. So in that sense, it's like, okay, well, Russia's willing to lie at these games.
Mm-hmm.
What else on a grander geopolitical? You can infer.
You can extrapolate. Yeah.
And it also, I think, shows a sense of, you know, how negative it can be to live in Russia.
Yeah. Well, for sure.
Can be. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of Russians who have fine
experience. I would actually say, and they mention Edward Snowden in the movie, but I'd say this would make a very good double feature with Glenn Greenwald's documentary about Snowden that came out a few years ago. I think won Best Documentary, which I'm forgetting the title of right now.
I saw him interviewed by John Oliver.
Yeah.
Is it? Was that called Snowden?
No, that was the movie that Oliver Stone did later with Joseph Gordon-Levitt. Yeah. But there was a documentary that came out a couple years before that Glenn Greenwald directed. But they're very similar in tone and kind of in concept, because it's about hiding a person and such, a person of interest and a whistleblower and that kind of stuff. But it's good. I like the movie. I like the journey that it took me on. But there were moments when I realized how movie-ish it was being. And like, especially there's some kind of poetics of like weaving in Orwellian prose and that kind of stuff. And there's some animation stuff that, you know, a lot of documentaries incorporate that stuff just to keep you looking at visuals. Mm-hmm. 'Cause not all documentaries are terribly visual. And so they add in some animation to kind of bounce it up a little bit. But sometimes I feel like the documentary is trying too hard to be a movie. But other than that, I think it's super interesting. And I haven't seen the other documentary competitors, but I feel like, you know, if we're going back to Vegas, Heart, blah, 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 this has a good shot. Specifically because of the political implications of sort of Russian scandal.
What did you think about it, Ashley?
I mean, I liked it. I was more fascinated than I thought I would, but mainly because I deal with these drugs every day.
Sure.
So it was kind of fun for me in that sense. And I also probably knew more stuff on a level that you guys didn't. But there's something really bothered. Like, the Russia stuff was cool and very fascinating and terrifying. But I wanted to know, like, did he pass his drug test? Like,
They kind of dropped that plot.
They never answered the entire original question. Yes, and that always bugged me. I was like, well, I want to know, did it work? Like, did you get it to work? Clearly, Russia had that system for their players, but we're talking about you doping and you tricking the system. Like, did it work?
Yeah.
And it never answers that, and that's frustrating.
The documentary kind of drops that whole original premise, yeah.
I agree, and that was sort of my frustration with the setup, was because it's so out of the realm of this Russian conspiracy, that it is frustrating that the science experiment, the supersize me part of it, doesn't have any resolution. I get why, because it does get pretty dramatic, and there's a point where Grigor is literally running for his life from the Russian government. So I doubt he cared about these fucking lab results. but yeah, it is frustrating that. And I also think the movie's a little over long.
It is. There's a moment definitely where I'm like, all right, like, this is still happening.
I thought it was really fascinating, but it could have been, I think they could have expedited, especially since they don't finish the experiment. It was really interesting, but they could have shortened that quite a bit so that we get to what the actual movie's about.
Mm-hmm.
I get that the twist isn't as effective, but, you know, that's like halfway through the movie. So,
yeah.
Overall, I think it's an interesting watch, and it's a lot more compelling than you might think it is.
Right, especially if you don't really care about sports or modern medicine or anything. What did you think, Ashley, specifically about, like, the details? Because they go into a very, very fine details of, like, these pee bottles with the screwy caps and on the breaking caps and all of that stuff. Do you think they get a little too in the weeds on that?
A little bit. I think the reason why they did that, and you're specifically talking about the Olympic pee bottles.
Yes.
For Olympic testing, is to show to what extent Russia was willing to cheat.
Mm-hmm,
and I think that is the point. It was like, we didn't have to know that these have, like, crazy... how many fail-safes there is to, like, not be able to open a pee bottle. But it was to prove that Russia is crazy. And that sports would matter so much to a country. Like, perhaps I don't see the appeal in, like, what winning would really matter. Like, you don't get more money. Like, there's nothing that really leverages your country one way or the other. But for Russia, it means so much for some reason.
Well, the big three countries in the Olympics has always been the United States, Russia, and China.
Mm-hmm.
And then South America.
Japan's a pretty big one. Canada can be, especially Winter Olympics. Canada's pretty big. But I mean, you know, this goes back forever. Like, the whole hockey thing with it. It's Russia wants to prove to the world that they want to be the world leader.
Yeah.
Because for a long time, Western civilization, at least from the Americans' perspective, is that America is held to that standard. And I think as far as global leadership, most people would agree with that. And Russia has always sort of wanted that leadership role post-World War II. And so it's always been this competition. And it's weird. I think it's, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's like, it's an old thing that's still playing out.
But, I mean, they did point out as well is Putin was so keen on winning because he was not polling well in his country. Mm-hmm. And by winning the Olympics, his approval ratings went through the roof because it gave the Russian people something excited to look forward to. So
yeah, and they also think
I guess that, in that sense, that's the political pull of cheating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, if you're... Yeah. I also think going into that level of detail gives credibility to Grigory's story. Because there's, you know, there's a point when the WADA, the Olympics Commission, and the U.S. government... and even Russian propaganda are all questioning the credibility of the story. And and at the end of the movie, it sounds like he was basically discredited and disavowed in Russia. He's fake news.
Yeah.
And so I think the detail, the level of detail that they do show the conspiracy is important to say, hey, he's not just making this up. Like who would, you know, this is insane. Like, I could barely even follow it. It got so in the weeds.
Yeah.
So I think there's a purpose, but that is sort of, I thought.
Maybe it was not necessarily the footage, because I think it is important to show how difficult it should be to cheat. Right. Maybe it's its placement in the film, because it's at that point where you're kind of feeling like you want to wrap up, and they decide, let's talk about pee bottles for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Right. True. I think ultimately... what sparked this conversation after this documentary me and Keith discussed is, do you think doping is cheating? Like, should it count? Like, it's still your physical ability. Like,
and if all the athletes are doing it, why is it even cheating?
Some don't.
Sure, because they think it's cheating and they're honest. But if everybody's like, all right, let's just dope. Like, if we just... They never really talk about why it's illegal.
Right.
If everybody does it and it's like, they just... regiment it, and they're like, okay, you can only dope this much or whatever. Sure, people cheat then too, but
yeah,
I.
But that's the thing, is there's no way to guarantee a level playing field for every athlete.
I mean, you can't. There's no such thing as a level playing field anyway. The idea is you train and you work to be better than the other person.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea, but everybody's biology is different. Everybody's everybody's economy is different. The reason those countries do well in the Olympics is because we have access to such good trainers and such good medical equipment and training equipment. So there's no such thing as a level playing field. It doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
It never has. You know, I mean, Tonga has the one shirtless oil guy, right? Like, that's the reason the countries are, yeah. So the idea of a level playing field sort of is silly to me.
Okay. I mean, I don't really have that much of an opinion. I think ultimately, if we're gonna compete, it should be as honest as possible.
Fuck it. If we're going to make superhuman athletes compete for our entertainment, God damn it. I want to be entertained. Pump them till they're fucking meat mutants. Yeah. And just let them have at it.
I think it's hard to say, like, what is a level playing field? Like, we're the U.S. We have tons of money. Mm. We can pump into these programs. Tonga has no money. And they can't afford to spend all this money on training for these athletes. So that's... that's why the richer countries win.
Yeah.
And
when those smaller countries win, really, it's so
fulfilling. I mean, if you really want to make it even, like, you have to, like, evenly distribute the money and the trainers. And so, like, I think that's where it comes hard.
Yeah.
But it's just, I guess it just comes down to, it's like, do you think a chemical stimulation counts as cheating?
Yeah.
Which, I mean, right now, according to the rules, it does. I'm just like, why not just change the rules? When you get to the, and I'm not going to say they're all doing it, but when you get to the point when all the major players are doing it, and they're hiding it, and they're getting suspended, and there's all these huge legal issues, and there's just fuck it. Fuck it.
There's Keith's controversial opinion on juicing.
I just don't care. I would rather just, I'm sick of hearing about it when it's so many people who do it. And so many of them get away with it. That's why I'm like, just fuck it. And on that note...
And on that note, what was the movie that Rod wanted us to do next week?
The Discovery. The Discovery. What are you, a fucking short story that I'm reading in my lit class written in 1927? Fuck you. Come up with a better name.
So next week, for our Netflix homework, we'll be talking about The Discovery.
We'll be discovering it.
this is a request by Rod of the Listening Party.
I'm not shitting on your request, Rod. I actually was genuinely interested in this movie anyway. I'm sick of shitty titles.
Things that we can't remember unless we're looking at Twitter.
The Discovery. I'm excited for the Natalie Portman one, Annihilation.
Mm-hmm.
Annihilation. Tells me nothing about the movie.
I know. And what do they... There's a... Never mind. I
was gonna... Arrival.
Yeah.
Call it Squiddy Ink Aliens. That's a better name. Squiddy Ink Future Times.
If it came out in 1953, that's what it would have been called. And it would have been a Corman movie.
Fucking A.
Okay, so that's the show. Ashley, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And when we'll have you again when after the Oscar telecast to recap all of our predictions.
That's right.
Things, you can find our show on jabberinthedrone.podbean.com as our regular archives. You can email us with your Oscar predictions or anything we talked about here or other requests for Netflix homework. At jabberinthedrone@gmail.com.
Whoever has, I'm going to just say this right now. Any of our listeners who do an Oscar ballot, whoever has the closest one will win a prize. It will be a dumb prize, and it will probably be something via Twitter or Instagram, but you'll win.
Okay, I'm putting Keith on prize detail.
It will be dumb, but you'll win.
And you can also find us and follow us on Twitter at Jabber Podcast. You can find me individually at VC Cassidy. Before we have Keith going all of his stuff, Ashley, do you want people to follow you on Twitter or on Instagram or anything?
Sure. You can follow me on Instagram at VROW19.
All right. Lots of pictures, lots of cats.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. you can Instagram me your, pharmacy question.
There you go.
Yes, all answered for you.
Unless it's about finding illegal drugs somehow, right?
Yeah, you don't need to ask me for that. That's pretty easy to find. You can also tweet at me. My Twitter is very hard to find. Just find Keith's, and I'm attached to it somehow.
You're Le Chat Noir.
Yeah.
But with underscores. So L-E-S underscore C-H-A-T underscore N-O-I-R. Mm-hmm. You gotta learn to promote.
Thanks. I have like 30 followers, so
there you go.
Yeah, follow me.
Okay, cool. You can read my reviews. I do that at the Idaho State Journal at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can also read the content I provided for the Seattle-based website, MacGuffin, at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. Keith, where do people find you?
Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. I think I'm on Facebook at Keith Foster Kid. Go to keithfosterkid.com. Check out Tonight in San Diego on all the social medias. Yeah, Tonight in San Diego, we're still in hiatus. It's going to be longer before we come back than we originally thought. We were originally planning on coming back in March. It seems like we run into a couple snags that's going to delay things. But I don't know if I can announce this yet. So I don't think I will.
Are you NDA'd?
No. we've got some stuff that we're working on to sort of keep the brand alive until the show comes back in a full capacity.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'll update more when I know more and stuff's more official, because everything could still very much fall apart at this point.
Okay.
So, yeah, just keep your eyes out. We'll have stuff coming out. And then...
We have a show this Saturday!
Yeah, we have a show this Saturday at 10:30 at Finest City Improv.
Select to the future. We take you to the future. We take you to the past. We take you to improv.
We do. We do all those things. This Friday, I don't know if this comes out on Thursday usually.
Yeah.
I'm doing Birdhouse Comedy Proudly Presents. Adam Connie is doing a live taping of his podcast. Mm-hmm. And he invited me to do some comedy for that show. So I have that show coming up. I have another show that doesn't have an official date yet. I have a few of those, so...
Look on your website.
Yeah. Go to KeithFosterKid.com.
You'll see all the things.
Mm-hmm.
Be sure to check out our friends who are also doing podcasts, Ron and Denise, at the Listening Party. They're back. They're in full swing. They're doing every week now. Winston Conrad, friend of the show, Winston, recently did an episode with them. It was a lot of fun. They're going to have more guests. They're going to do some more solo episodes. Check out Denise's The Mascot Diaries. It's not totally done yet. Also check out Patrick and Dennis at Almost Educational and Patrick and his father at Make Dad Read Comics. Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums podcast. They just talked about The Clash's London Calling. Long time coming. Was great as expected. You, Adam Connie at...
The Adamant podcast. Check that out. And Blizzlet.
And Mike Falick over at Let's Start a Cult. He's now editing in our question-answer segment that we did as a bonus episode last week.
Yeah. I do have a question for Mike, because I know you're probably going to listen to this. Did you eat your ferret? Or did you get the amount of likes on iTunes? Did you get the amount of 5-star reviews? Because you had a week, and me and Deepu settled this. If you didn't get 15 5-star reviews in a week because of your fucking post, you got to eat your fucking ferret. And here's the thing. I don't want you to eat your ferret, but I want some goddamn accountability in this world.
All right. So that's the show. And Keith, take it away.
Cookies are for closers.
Good luck, boss baby.